Blog Talk Radio.
It's the Morning Show.
Okay, you want to rehearse one time before we go in there?
With award-winning journalist Cheryl Smith.
I'm good. I'm not that good.
Bringing you informative, enlightening, thought-provoking, inspiring, and entertaining talk radio.
Good afternoon or morning. I guess I should say morning. Well, you are watching and listening to the Blog Talk Show. I was just thinking, And I am Norma Adams Wade, your host. And you, as I always remind you, are my co-host. And I tell you that I stole that from Wendy Williams blatantly. Let me talk about my mask. I am determined to honor the health mandates of our health officials, national, local. There is such a heated, as you already know, there is such a heated debate going on right now about masks. Before I go a little further about it, let me just say that my mask protects you from me, and your mask protects me from you. So it's a kind of a mutual sharing thing. We know all the other mandates about social distancing and washing your hands and what have you. And when we are around other people, we are to be respectful of their health protection. But since I'm in a room, I'm in a building with other people, but I'm in a room by myself. So I am going to go ahead and take my mask off while I'm in the room here. You can learn a lot more about the sponsor of the blog show, which is Texas Metro News. This is one of the earlier publications, iMessenger Media and the Garland Journal. Wonderful, very informative local publications, African-American owned, proudly. On the second half of the show today, we're going to have a guest who's going to tell us about a very necessary service that's expanding here locally in Dallas, and it helps protect women and families, and we're going to really get into that later. I also want to tell you that if you would like to have a comment, you can comment in our chat here on the screen, or you can call in. We have a call-in number, which is 646-200-0459. And that's the call-in number if you would like to call in and make a live comment. I am going to begin today with some Black history points. You know, I've told you before, I love Black history. I didn't always, but I have become a lover of African American history. And so we're going to begin today with a little local Black History Moments, I like to call it. And then we'll talk a little bit about what's going on in the news, and then we'll have our guest. I'm going to get right in to Black History Moment. You probably, and maybe you haven't heard the name Paul Lawrence Dunbar. And I mention him because in early Dallas Black history, back in the 1930s, the first library that served African Americans in Dallas opened in 1931, and it was named for him. And we'll talk a little bit more. Now, we coming on down through the generations, we do have now a current Paul Lawrence Dunbar Library, but it is a descendant of the original, and the original has just a very impactful history. But let's just say talk a little bit about who Paul Lawrence Dunbar was. Dunbar was the first influential Black poet in American literature who was internationally acclaimed for his dialect verse. Now we'll talk a little bit more about dialect. This current generation probably hasn't paid much attention to dialect, but we'll talk about it. And he was the first noted African American to actually write in Black dialect. And he wrote a collection of writings, and he was noted as the first writer to write about the African American experience using dialect. And he put this experience and the use of dialect to a broader, wide-ranging, multi-ethnic audience in the nation. And so Paul Lawrence Dunbar, a noted literary writer, he was born to parents who had been enslaved. His parents had been enslaved, and he was born in the early 1870s, and he died in the early 1900s. And when he was born, the president was Ulysses S. Grant when Paul Lawrence Dunbar was born. And not only was he a poet, but he was a novelist, and he wrote short stories. And he even did the lyrics for a musical that played on Broadway. It was called In Da Homie, and it was the first all-African-American musical that was produced on Broadway in New York, and that was in the early 1900s, in 1903. And the musical became pretty acclaimed, and it toured across the United States and in the United Kingdom. And so his life was not always easy, and it wasn't even after he became well noted. He still struggled some, and I'll just go ahead and tell you that he died early of tuberculosis, and he struggled with it, and he died at the age of 33, a young man of tuberculosis. And his life had ups and downs. Even at one point, he was an elevator operator just while he was still trying to write on the side, and he needed to put money in his pocket, so he was an elevator operator. And he did that for a while he was still writing. But he got a lot of noted Anglo literary people who took notice of him and helped him. And he also was a classmate and friend of the Wright brothers, putting us in airplanes. He was a classmate of them, and interestingly, I found this pretty interesting. Paul Lawrence Dunbar was the only African American student during his years at Central High School in Dayton, Dayton, Ohio. He was born in Dayton, Ohio. And he was, how did that happen, that early period of time? Like, again, he was born in the 1872, and then high school, he was the only African-American student in his class. How did it happen? But it happened, and he even was editor of that school newspaper, and he was a member of the debate club. So that's just a kind of a early history. Segregation was so strong, but there in Dayton, Ohio, he was even the only African-American in his high school class. But let's move on about his life and talk about this first library for African-Americans in Dallas. And I must pay tribute to writer, researcher Paula Bossa here, who writes a blog in Dallas, and she's done it for a while. It's called Flashback Dallas, and she did a lot of research on the Paul Lawrence Dunbar Branch Library. It was a branch of the Dallas Public Library, so I must pay tribute to her for her stellar research work on this subject. Now, this library, the Paul Lawrence Dunbar Library, was the first to serve African Americans in Dallas. And again, I said it opened in 1931 in the St. Thomas area of Freedmantown. It was right at the corner of Thomas Avenue and Worthington, kind of not too far from the McKinney area, but we call it short North Dallas. But it was the Freedmantown right there, still where the old Freedman Cemetery, all up in that area off of North Central Expressway. And so this library, the leaders, the African-American leaders of Dallas really worked hard to get a library for Black people in Dallas, because Blacks were not allowed during segregation during that time. They were not allowed to use the main library in downtown Dallas. It was called the Carnegie Library. It was at the site where the current library is, but that building was later torn down and replaced with the current building that is now at, Harwood and Main, I think it is. But it was originally called the Carnegie Library from benefactor Dale Carnegie, who's wealthy Anglo individual. And so the in this area of short North Dallas were pretty well off community for African American citizens. You had all kind of, you've heard the story of Freedmantown and short North Dallas. You had doctors and lawyers and a pretty good mixture of economic income of African Americans. But again, segregation was so strong, and even the African American schools, they had no functioning libraries at the time. And so the leaders fought long and hard, and finally they were able to get this library for African Americans, and they named it for Paul Lawrence Dunbar because of his achievements in the literary field. And so the building became very, very popular, very, very popular building. And the Dallas Public Library archives, they've got all kind of photographs of this building. It was a nice, well, strong, sturdy building. The interior was very, very nice. The outside was very nice. And one photo that struck me was the photo in the Dallas Public Library archives that showed opening day. I mean, there were wall-to-wall children and adults. And this photograph, this shows them just filling every space of the library on opening day in 1931. And then there are also photographs of school children having different activities at the library. And one showed them dressed up in character costumes where they were celebrating National Book Week, dressed up in different characters. There's a photograph in the yearbook, the Lincoln High School yearbook, that shows and the exterior of the Paul Lawrence Dunbar Library with the African-American citizens milling around out front. The official address was 2721 Thomas Avenue. And then we've heard the story about Central Expressway coming through that area of Dallas and how it just demolished so much African-American history in that area. And so in the late 1940s, now remember the library was opened in 31, I think we said, and then in the late 1940s, construction on Central Expressway began, and it cut right through the heart of that African-American community, thriving community of Short North Dallas, right north of downtown Dallas. That's why they call it Short North Dallas, because we're not talking Far North Dallas, but it's called Short North Dallas because it was just right past downtown Dallas. But the Central Expressway cut through that, and it just destroyed so many just well-achieved buildings and homes, nice homes. And of course, we know about the destruction that to Freedman Cemetery. A lot of former enslaved Africans were buried at Freedman Cemetery. And when that expressway came, it just cut right through the cemetery. Just devastating. But the cemetery and a lot of buildings and residents and what have you just were gone in the early 1940s when Central Expressway came through there. But now the library, that building still stood during all that, even though its surrounding community was demolished. But then because so many people had been displaced and had to move to other areas of Dallas by the 1950s. Now, remember, it opened in the 30s. By the 1950s, the library, the Paul Lawrence Dunbar Libraries, exclusively for Dallas African Americans, had lost so many of its core clients and patrons that it was struggling to continue to exist because the surrounding community pretty much was gone. So finally, in 1959, the library closed, and that was just a sad moment. It was, as I said, it was a beautiful building, well constructed. And then it was demolished finally. After it closed in 59, it was demolished. Now, we know now that whole Short North Dallas area is known as Uptown. So much of our history now has been replaced by gentrification and well-off Anglos live in that area now called Uptown. And Dr. Mamie Magnite, I can remember the late Dr. Mamie Magnite fought so hard to preserve a lot of the history of that area. And she fought successfully. Black Dallas Remembered, and its predecessor is Remembering Black Dallas, that organization that has fought valiantly to preserve a lot of our local Black history. And that whole episode kind of reminds me of what you hear. You know, we've heard through the years that Dallas is known as a city that really doesn't honor history. We honor glitz and glamour. We want the flashy buildings and the flashy development. You know, there are some cities who thrive on preserving their history. But Dallas is not one of those cities. We like the glitz and glamour story of the Hall of Negro Life at Fair Park. And we know that during the Texas Centennial, we're aware that observed Texas independence from Mexico, which was won in 1836. So in 1936, the Texas Centennial World Fair was held at Fair Park, and this wonderful Hall of Negro Life, a building was constructed, and so much valuable history about the life of African Americans called the Hall of Negro Life. And you've heard the story. Once that Centennial World Fair was over, and that one building was the only building that was demolished of all the other buildings that were constructed during that Centennial World Fair at Fair Park. That was the only one that was demolished. And so all of that just kind of brings back memories about how Dallas has really kind of not honored its history. And it also kind of reminds me of sort of a Dallas Black Wall Street. Now, we didn't lose lives like with Black Wall Street in Tulsa, but we lost so much valuable history and property and buildings and homes and businesses. It kind of reminds me of that. But the Dallas Public Library, I have to, and again, Paula Bossa, who did up some valuable research on this Paula Dunbar Library. But a lot of it is still, you can find it, photographs and what have you, at the Dallas Public Library. There is a book, it's called Dallas Public Library, Celebrating a Century of Service. And that book was published in early 2000, but it has a good chapter about the Dunbar Library in that book, and how the African-American leaders had to just fight so hard to get that library built. But there is a chapter about it in that book. And around that, the building was that Paula Dunbar Library was designed by two Anglo architects. One was Ralph Bryant and the other was Walter Sharp. And guess what? They also did the architecture of the Lincoln High School building that opened in 1939, about almost a decade after the Paula Dunbar Library. So, and also they did the architectural design on the original Moreland YMCA, which is where the Dallas Black Dance Theater now has its headquarters. And so these two Anglo architects, Ralph Bryant and Walter Sharp, designed those three key structures that serve the Dallas African American community: Paula Dunbar Library, Moreland Branch YMCA, the original one in the downtown area that's now the headquarters of the Dallas Black Dance Theater, and Lincoln High School. So we owe them a debt of gratitude. Now, currently, as I said, there was a period when after the original Paula Dunbar Library closed, there was a period when there was not one, but currently we have a Paul Lawrence Dunbar that is on East Keith Boulevard, and it had a previous location in the Oak Cliff area, and so this would be like the third location, but it's right across from Oliver Wendell Holmes Middle School on Keith Boulevard in the Oak Cliff area. And so lots of history, and we're just so glad that we do currently have a subsequent library that we can say is carrying on the legacy of the original Paul Lawrence Dunbar Library. And some people do still can remember that. And in this piece that researcher Paula Bossi did, several people commented that, yeah, they remembered. They remembered that building, that original building in the Freedmantown area, and how important it was to the African-American community. And they were just, you know, really grateful to her when she did her research and brought out that history. Now, let me remind you that you are watching and listening to the Blog Talk Show, I Was Just Thinking. And I am your host, Norma Adams Wade. And we are awaiting a very informative conversation that we're going to have concerning a new service in Dallas that will serve particularly, not just exclusively, but it will be a multi-ethnic service, but it really will do a lot for African-American women and families. And we're going to hear all about that later, but you're listening to the Blog Talk Show, I Was Just Thinking, and I am your host, Norma Adams Wade. Now, let me tell you a little bit more about the work, the writing of Paul Lawrence Dunbar. And one of his very well-known poems is called, and you may have heard it, he wrote it back in 1896. And try to see if you can follow what he's saying about our experience in the late 1800s. And it's called We Were the Mask. And so here it is. It's in three stanzas. He says, "We were the mask that grins and lies. It hides our cheeks and shades our eyes. This debt we pay to human guile with torn and bleeding hearts. We smile and mild with myriad subtleties. Why should the world be overwise in counting all our tears and sighs? Now, let them only see us while we wear the mask. We smile, but oh great Christ, our cries to thee from tortured souls arise. We sing, but oh the clay is vile beneath our feet and long the mile. But let the world dream, otherwise we wear the mask." So what do you think Dunbar was saying about the African-American experience? I think he's talking about how we hide our inner selves with this little pleasant smile, like, oh, everything is fine, hunky-dory, we're okay. But inside, he says, we're covering our torn and bleeding hearts while we smile. He says, we're counting on our facial mask of smile to cover our tears and our sighs and the tortured souls that we feel inside. And he says, we smile, but we're crying out to a higher power about our inner turmoil. But he says, let the world dream while we wear the mask. And then his other work, as we said, Dunbar was noted. He was noted for writing in dialect. Now, dialect is a controversial method of writing. He put it out there. You know, we call it, it's also called Ebonics. We can call it Ebonics. But he actually wrote many of his poems. Now, he wrote in standard English many writings, but he really was noted for his writing in dialect. And my personal memory of his work is when I was in grade school, my fourth grade, I think she was either fourth or third grade, but her name was Miss Nona Bell. And she used to read this particular poem to us in her class. And it's called When Melinda Sings. Oh, I have such memories of my third or fourth grade teacher, Miss Nona Bell. And boy, she's a little lady, short, about 4 feet tall, chunky, full. But boy, she could recite this poem called When Melinda Sings, and it's written in dialect, and Dunbar wrote it in the late 1890s. So here we go, When Melinda Sings, and it's in dialect, and visualize Miss Nona Bell reciting it. She says, won't and quit that noise, Miss Lucy. Put that music book away. What's the use to keep on trying? If you practice till you great, you can't start no notes a flying like the ones that rants and rings from the kitchen to the woods when Melinda sings. You ain't got the natural organs but to make the sound come right. You ain't got the tunes and twistings but to make it sweet and light. Tell you one thing now, Miss Lucy, and I'll tell you for sure, when it comes to royal right singing, ain't no easy thing to do. Easy enough for folks to holler, looking at the lines and dots, when there ain't no one can sense it, and the tune come in spots. But for real melodious music that just strikes your heart and clings, just you stand and listen with me when Melinda sings. Ain't you never heard Melinda? Bless your soul, take up the cross. Look here. Ain't you joking, honey? Well, you don't know what you lost. You ought to hear that gal a-wobbling, robins and larks and all them things. Her stay miles and high they face when Melinda sang. Oh, it's sweeter than the music of an educated band. And it's dearer than the battle songs of triumph in the land. It seems holier than evening when the solemn church bells ring. And I sit and calmly listen when Melinda sings. Tasha, stop that bacon, hear me? Mindy, make that child quit, keep still. Don't you hear the echoes calling from the valley to the hill? Let me listen. I can hear it. Those the breast of angels' wings, soft and sweet. Swing low, sweet chariot, as Melinda sings. That was Paul Lawrence Dunbar, noted for writing dialect, and that was my tribute to my third and fourth grade teacher, Miss Nona Bell. I can see her now reciting that to our class. Let's see. We're gonna talk some about what's been going on in the news lately. There was an interesting piece in the news, early this week, about how Child Protective Services, their cases are so overloaded with investigations about incidents involving African-American children way more than with children of other ethnic groups. And the study shows agency investigates Dallas and Tarrant County youth and what they learned from it. And it gave an example about it. The report gave an example about a young kid who grew up as a latchkey kid in Dallas. And around 9 years old, he would walk home from grade school, and he was in the Lakewood neighborhood, an Anglo child. And he would take the walk from the bus stop to his home. So it was fairly uneventful, no big deal. But the report said if this same incident was put into the African-American community, that could be considered in some instances child neglect, because he's 9, he's walking home from school alone, he's a latchkey kid, he has to let himself in. So the Child Protective Services on similar incidents have been called to many families and have gotten involved, and the children have been removed for things that would be kind of overlooked in other areas. And so the report says that whether the family is investigated as a result can depend on that family's race. And so the recent study was called Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that investigated this phenomena. And it was done at Rutgers and Duke University. And it found that the 20 most populous counties in the United States, contact with CPS is pervasive, consistent with whether these are African-American children or not. Now, the Texas trend tracked the national trend, and in Dallas and Tarrant County, Harris and Bexar County, about half of all African-American children will be investigated by CPS by age 18. Now get that. In Harris and Bexar County, in Dallas, Tarrant, Harris, and Bexar County, about half of all African-American children will be investigated by Child Protective Services by age 18. And so that rate means that Black children are overrepresented in initial interactions with child welfare system. The racial disparity increases in later stage interventions by CPS, such as confirmed maltreatment or neglect, foster care, and termination of parental rights. All of this can happen in African American families when with other ethnic groups, it would kind of be largely ignored, the incidences that CPS gets involved with. Now, these disparities, the report said, are a reflection of profound racial, income, wealth, and housing inequities. And each intervention comes with not only the human cost of family stress and instability, but also an economic part to it. It costs money to do these investigations. Now, in Dallas County, the study found African-American children are 1.88 times more likely than white children to be investigated by CPS and 2.29 times more likely to enter foster care. Now, in Harris County, which includes Houston, the Gulf is even wider. African-American children are 1.95 times more likely to be investigated and 3.24 times more likely to enter foster care. Now, the state of Texas has struggled with capacity issues in foster care placement, and partly due to a lack of funding for increasing provider payments. Now, in June, 415 children stayed in unlicensed foster homes, like churches and motels and even offices. Now, the latest challenge in a system that is so plagued that it has faced a decade-long federal lawsuit over failure to adequately care for foster children. So these figures are disproportionate. And also, it says that parents have immediate safety nets, such as family members who can provide child care. Then their children may never come into contact with CPS if they have this safety net of family members who can help them with their children. But there are so many African-American families who are single parents or maybe living in a city away from the rest of their family, and they just don't have that safety net. And so here comes CPS marching into their circumstances. Why was this child left alone? Why was this child having to walk from a bus stop all the way home at a certain age? And the mother, the single mother, is out trying to earn a living. So one investigator said, for children who are in long-term foster care and they may even end up aging out of foster care, the outcomes are not encouraging. And so this study is really trying to help rectify this situation. And so another commenter said, we're taking a complex social problem and we're trying to manage it through surveillance and punishment rather than through social support. So the question is this the right approach to address a family crisis and to address children who are in crisis? So that's the question. So the situation of Child Protective Service investigating single parents, hardworking single families, single moms, trying to raise their children. And what they're going to do, they don't have a backup safety net. And so hopefully that study will help to alleviate that. I wanted to also mention about, y'all know the name of Josephine Baker, the dancer Josephine Baker, really important early predecessor of dance. She was an American. She was born in America, but she became very famous in Europe and France. So her remains will be reinterred at the Parthenon Monument in Paris. So this will make her she was considered a World War II hero in France, and she was the first African-American woman to get that country's highest honor. And so the local newspaper there reported in recent days that the president of France, Macron, decided to organize a ceremony at the Paris Monument. But after her death in 1975, she was buried in Monaco, and she was dressed in a French military uniform with the medals that she received for her role as part of the French resistance. So not only was she a groundbreaking African-American pioneer dancer, but she was considered a hero of the French resistance. She left America segregation and inequities were very, very strong during her time. And so, but she got her due respect in Europe and France. And so she will be reinterred at the Parthenon Monument in Paris. So I thought that's a great honor. That's a great honor for her. Did you know that the Biden administration has announced that it will automatically erase student loan debt for more than 300,000 Americans that have severe disabilities that leaves them unable to earn significant income? So for more than 300,000 African Americans who have severe disabilities, the Biden administration will automatically erase their student loan debt. That's opening the door for maybe more work about alleviating a student loan debt, because, you know, that's a long-standing effort that many people have pushed for. Now, the move will wipe out more than $5.8 billion in debt, according to the Education Department, and it marks the start of a broader overhaul of a program that has been criticized for having overly burdensome rules. Now, the federal government offers student debt relief for people who are totally and permanently disabled and have limited income, but the current rules require them to submit documentation of their disabilities and to undergo a 3-year monitoring period to prove that they are not earning sufficient money. It's very, very cumbersome government rules. Now, tens of thousands of people have been dropped from the program because they didn't give adequate proof. They were disabled, but they, with all of this rigorous proof that's needed, they weren't able to give it or do it or complete it, and they were dropped from the program. But this latest move is attempting to rectify that. And so under this new action, both demands will be met, where it will lighten the requirements. And then starting in September, the Education Department will start erasing this student debt for 323,000 Americans who are identified in Social Security records as being permanently disabled. And so borrowers will be notified once these people have been approved for relief. And all of the loans are expected to be discharged by the end of this year. So that's life. That's an open door for debt relief, an open door. Have you been keeping up with the booster, the talk about booster shots? Now the Johnson and Johnson. Now, you know, we've got Moderna, Pfizer, and Johnson and Johnson. And so there is a need for the Johnson & Johnson booster to continue to be studied. Now, Pfizer, the FDA recently completely approved the Pfizer injection. And so there's an ongoing more than 13 million people in the U.S. have received the one-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And so the federal health authorities officially recommended the COVID-19 booster shot, saying that people who received both the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines will need an extra shot 8 months after their second dose. So I'm going to start preparing for mine. What about you? The new guidelines issued have left the more than 13.9 million people in the U.S. who received the one dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine kind of confused about whether they are still protected against this coronavirus, and especially the more contagious Delta variant. Now, health officials say the people who receive the one-dose regimen will likely also need a booster at some point, but that they are waiting for more data to know for sure. And so there are all kind of studies going on about it. Now, the Pfizer and Moderna shots were also rolled out much earlier, and that means that researchers have more data to analyze those than they currently have for Johnson & Johnson. So we're going to stay tuned. Now, also, President Biden and First Lady Jill Biden, they will get their booster shots in December. They're first top front of the line. They're going to get right out front and get their booster shot, and they're going to do that in December. Now, the president was interviewed about it, and it says that it's past time for him to get a booster, and U.S. health officials recommended that Americans who received the Moderna or the Pfizer in 8 months, you start lining up or getting ready to get a booster shot after you have know for sure that you have completed your second dose. That's the two-shot variant. And as I said, there are still studies going on concerning the Johnson and Johnson. And so a lot of things going on in the news. Did y'all follow about the whole argument about voting inequities and Governor Abbott and the Democrats, three of the Democrats coming back to Texas and allowing the Republicans to vote on their interpretation of what they call voter protection. We call it voter suppression. But there's so much to keep up with concerning that. Again, let me remind you, you are watching and listening to the Blog Talk Show. I Was Just Thinking, and I am Norma Adams Wade, your host, and you are my co-host, and we're pretty soon getting close to having our guest on. But I'm going to take a short break, and we will be back fairly soon. And when we come back, we will say welcome to our guests. I shall return. It's been too hard
It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gon' come. Oh, yes it will. I go to the movies and I go downtown. Somebody keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long time coming, but I know change gon' come. Oh, yes it will. Then I go to my brother and I say, brother, help me please. But he winds up back down on my knees. Oh, there've been times that I thought I could last alone, but now I think I'm able to carry on. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gon' come. Oh, yes it will.
Well, hello, everybody. I'm back. And let's see what we have here. Okay.
She's getting there. Oh, no, that's me.
Following about Texas Governor Abbott testing positive for COVID. And then a few days, well, then he got all kind of treatment. And then a few days later, he was negative again. I'll let you make your own conclusion. But I don't know. It just, to me, it just speaks so much about special privilege. I hate to say that, but our leaders, and we have to include our former president and so many upscale, economically upscale people, when they have come down with COVID-19, they do. I mean, the truth of the reality is they get all kinds of special services that lower income communities don't get, and that the deaths and the aftermath are so traumatic that it just gives you pause. Okay, I see that we have our guest. Well, hello, and before I tell everybody who you are, let's see, can I hear you?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, very good, very good. Welcome, welcome, welcome. But before I start talking to you, let me tell everybody who you are. Okay, everyone, this is Janet, and help me out with Tanase Langbein.
Langbein.
Is that right, Langbein?
Yes.
Okay, everybody, this is Jan Langbein, and she is the CEO of a expanding service, which is called Genesis Women's Shelter and Support. Now, Genesis has been around for, I think, more than 30 years or so, but she's going to give us all of that. But why we're talking about it today is, now, Genesis, women, we all know about domestic violence, and that's their forte, is to serve women. And I must say, in our community, the African-American community, there's a lot of need. Not that women across the board don't need services for domestic violence, but our community particularly does. So I'm going to just let you know that this is Jan Langbein, and she is the CEO of Genesis Women's Shelter, and I'm going to turn it over to her, and she's going to tell us about the new development of Genesis Women's Shelter and how it relates to the African-American community and why the need is so stark. You've got the floor.
I love the floor. Thank you so much for having me today. I appreciate the time to talk about Genesis, and I appreciate you hosting me today. So Genesis Women's Shelter and Support has been around for over 35 years, and what started as an emergency crisis intervention, an emergency shelter for women and children who are victims of domestic violence, has grown into a full-service response, what we call a continuum of care, that no matter what the needs are, whether it's shelter or counseling or advocacy or access to civil legal representation, then we stand ready to help women and children who have been victimized by intimate partners. Mm-hmm. We provide services for women who are battered by men, women who are battered by same-gender partners. The dynamics are the same. Okay. The cycle is the same.
Yes.
It is what we also refer to, Norma, as an equal opportunity epidemic because it knows no boundaries.
Yeah.
It happens in Highland Park. It happens in South Oak Cliff.
Mm.
It happens to educated and uneducated, and it is perpetrated by educated and uneducated.
Mm.
Just as women come from all socioeconomic backgrounds, all professions, all neighborhoods, so do perpetrators. They can wear a doctor's lab coat, a preacher's robe, their overalls, whatever it is. Again, it is a, as I say, an equal opportunity epidemic.
Yes, so, and let me jump in on that point, because that really strikes me, that what I heard you say is that don't try to put this in a category. All of these are just low income people beating up on their other half.
Right.
What I heard you say is that this is across the board. High-level people making a lot of money still can go home and abuse their other half.
And honestly, Norma, what we find is those who have more resources, financial resources, are able to hide it more, are able to get more legal representation that can literally strip her of any resource possible.
Mm.
Probably she has not worked outside the home.
Yeah.
He has, reduced any kind of connection that she has with family and friends or
mm-hmm.
faith community or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the dynamics are the same, but sometimes the more affluent, they have put all assets in their own name, and she has no access to any financial support.
And I want the audience to just pause and think about that. That there you are, your husband is making, or your partner. Your significant other is making high dollars. And like you just said, they can get attorneys. They can get this, that, and the other. You're just a little mousy,
right.
Hopeless, helpless female. And I think you're feeling trapped. You're feeling powerless. Is that true?
No, it is absolutely true. Now, I also want to say, yes, some women are that. They've never been allowed outside the home. But some women are very, very accomplished professional women. However, their entire paycheck goes directly into his bank account. She has no access to her own money. So the financial control he has over her is more effective than a lock and a key to keep it there.
Oh, my
because,
God.
Because the house is in his name, the car is in his name, the stock portfolio in his name, and the money perhaps that my mama sent me at Christmas that I bury in the bottom of the cereal box, well, he found that, and it's gone. So it's really something. But certainly, a lot of people think domestic violence is about a push, a slob, a shove, or a slap, but it is also about financial abuse. It can be about spiritual abuse. It can be emotional and verbal abuse. We've even seen in this last year and a half, Norma, COVID abuse, using COVID as an excuse to beat her, making her wash her hands until they bleed, won't let her go to the grocery store with a mask on, coughing in her face, threatening her with a disease. So I have to tell you, they will use the children as an excuse, any old excuse will do, right? And they will hurt you in a way that hurts you the most. Now, the most important thing to me in my life, the most important thing, my faith and my family. My children, my grandchildren are number one. God and I are working on that because I know he's supposed to be number one, but we're working on it. But I tell you, I would not leave without my children. I would take a beating for my grandchildren. Right. And so many times women see that there is no other option except our other options. And that's what I've come on here today to talk to you about.
Tell us about these other options.
Yeah, so Genesis does have a shelter, and that's what you think it is. I mean, it's not what you think it is. It's a beautiful old historic building, but it also has long-term transitional housing.
Okay.
But our biggest footprint is non-residential support. Women who either haven't left or they've left and have other residential resources, they can still access counseling information at no cost, advocacy, access to civil legal representation.
Let me jump in right there.
Okay.
I really want to stress the no cost, because to me, particularly in underserved communities, what I hear you saying is the woman who feels victimized, for lack of a better term, she doesn't have to worry about, can I pay for this? Can I pay the rent? Can I pay the utilities? This is no cost. Benefactors, and we'll talk about benefactors later, but someone has paid the price to open up a place for you to be safe, where you can just go in and not have to pay. Am I right?
No, you're absolutely right. And we do not request or do we receive government funds. So we're able to design our program based on her particular needs. So as I say, our biggest footprint is our non-residential center over on Lemon Avenue. But one of the things that I'm excited to share with you today is that studies tell us that African-American women are assaulted 35% more than white women.
Whoa.
Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that black men are more violent. It means it happens more often.
Okay.
However, there are so many roadblocks that would keep a woman of color from reporting, from seeking help. You know, certainly we all have roadblocks from doing that. But when I say 35% more than white women, that's not reflected in the demographics of the clients we serve. It's a much lower percentage.
Okay.
So we've been looking for many years for an opportunity to help serve underserved communities, and we're very excited to tell you that construction has started on a new facility in Southern Dallas, at the corner of Ledbetter and Lancaster.
Okay.
Right in the dark line, and it will be a counseling office, advocacy, access to all the services that we have, but you don't have to ride 5 buses to get here. And you don't have to, you know, go through all, we're not going to call the police, or we're not going to, we also are going to put on the very front of it a benefit thrift store, because we know women who need shoes for their child or don't have anything to eat that night cannot commit to a counseling program.
Right.
All our clients get to shop at no cost for what they need.
Let me ask this. That, to me, that's such a brilliant idea to have this thrift store. How did that come about? I mean, was that something y'all wrestled with in the past and somebody finally said, you know what, we need to make this event? How did that come about?
So we had, for, 25 years, had an amazing benefit thrift store down on Lemon at Wycliffe.
Okay.
It's wonderful. And the community is so generous. It's a way, Norma, that everybody can help. You can clean out your closet. You can get rid of your husband's golf shirt that you're so tired of looking at.
Okay.
In your garage, you have an extra set of dishes. Well, our families get to go and shop for those dishes to start a new life.
Okay.
Or the clothes to go to court. You know, faith communities could come together and have a drive to where, you know, we can fill up that benefit thrift store for the benefit of the Genesis client.
Okay.
But we've been operating that with all programs. assistance for 25 years down here in the Oakland area. But now we're going to have this in Southern Dallas.
Okay.
We're very excited about it. Hopefully it'll help pay the things we don't give away. If we can sell them, the things, those things can help pay the rent, I hope.
Right.
But anyway, it's going to be amazing. I don't know the hours yet, but
yeah,
we're roping it out. Construction has begun, as I say.
Well, now let me jump in and ask you about that particular site. Is there a reason why that site at, what did you say, Ledbetter and Lancaster, is there a special need there? Why that site?
Yes, ma'am. So it is that district, that zip code has the highest incidence of domestic violence. Now, we know it's high, but it isn't as high as it ought to be because there's really a lack of reporting, right?
Oh.
And so, but in one of the highest areas of domestic violence, there are no resources whatsoever. Now, many of the state communities have wonderful ministries going on, but we're that next step. So let's say in your church, your faith community, you do a walk in her shoes, or, you know, Bishop does a play, Bishop Campbell does a play, or, you know, all these things that are going on about domestic violence, but okay, then what? And I have to say, I think in that community, there has been a real disconnect, a lack of trust. I'm not some white savior up here trying to fix it.
Right, right.
I'm trying to walk beside the women of that community with people who are relatable in an office that is relatable and convenient, but with the cutting-edge services that we know can make a difference.
Right, right. Okay. Tell me a little bit more about this. There are statistics, and I think you said, 35% more well, I'm trying to get to the causes maybe or studies behind why the statistics are so much higher among the African-American community. Does systemic racism or the experiences of African-American men play into this? Does job come home and I had trouble on the job, so I go home and beat up my partner. Does that play into to these dynamics?
No doubt about it. Okay, so also, Norma, I want to share with you, whenever we do education in the community, we describe what is domestic violence, what is against the law, right?
Okay.
And so if someone hits you, that's against the law.
Mm-hmm.
And it includes your spouse. That's actually what the law says now, because before we changed that, it didn't seem to count if it was your spouse. But now, if somebody hits you, somebody hurts you, and it's an intimate partner, that's domestic violence.
Okay.
What we found as we were going forward with education materials in the African-American community is that Black women, and I know I'm generalizing here, but you're more likely to fight back.
Oh.
I'm going to curl up in a ball in the corner and wait until he finishes beating me, and I'm not going to say a thing. I have a friend who works here who's actually going to be the program manager down at the new center.
Okay.
And she told me one day, I said, you were screaming back at him. She's the survivor. And she goes, you know what? I knew that he was probably going to kill me that day, but my last words to him were going to be calling him a big son of a bitch on my way.
Okay, all right.
And I'm like, oh, my God. So what we have found, though, is because women of color, or particularly African-American women, will fight back,
yeah,
they feel like they have committed domestic violence. They don't understand that that's self-defense. That is not against the law,
right?
Fighting back when he's coming at you.
Right,
self-defense. And so that's another contributing factor, I think. He can get away with it. Until there is intervention, why would he stop beating you if he wants dinner on the table at 6 o'clock?
Yeah.
Why would he stop taking out a bad day on you unless somebody says, you're going to jail if you do, or you're going to have to go to counseling, or you're going to have to... Some accountability, you're going to have to get out. You're just going to have to get out. We need a community, Black, white, Republican, Democrat, stands and says, I have zero tolerance for violence against women and children. Zero tolerance. It needs to be said in our faith communities. It needs to be said in our hospitals, mm-hmm, in our grocery store, mm-hmm, on podcasts like this, African-American newspapers, in our sororities and fraternities.
Right.
Communities have a very big opportunity to not only support, mm-hmm, genocide, because I think a lot of people with ties and not give into the community. They'll give to their church.
Yeah, yeah.
And not community. Right. But if the communities will support us, we can provide services.
Okay, now I need to ask you this, and I hear, and you tell me right or wrong, but that in some instances, African-American women hesitate calling the police because it might end up being a George Floyd situation,
yes,
or something like that.
I don't want him killed.
Yeah.
I don't want him killed. If he goes to jail, he's the breadwinner, and there's no food on the table. A baby doesn't have any diapers.
Wow.
I don't want it. I don't want the law to get involved because I don't trust the law.
Right, there's right.
And we've all seen that. We've all had a graduate level course on cultural impact, the police cultural impact of the police on different cultures.
Right.
I worked very, very hard in Dallas to help create a department that understands that domestic violence is against the law, that the law says there shall be an arrest made.
Okay.
They're trained to know the difference between self-defense and the predominant aggressor.
Okay.
I train every new recruit at the Dallas Police Academy so that he can understand why she doesn't pack up and leave.
Yeah.
Why he can understand why he's back out at that same house Saturday night after Saturday night. She isn't beaten because she didn't leave. She's beaten because he beats her. Does that make sense?
It does. It does.
And we, as a society, Norma has to stop saying, why doesn't she get out, and move the needle and the conversation over to, why does he do it? Why does he do it, and why don't we stop that?
You know, now that's new thinking. That really is. And that brings in a whole dynamic that I really hadn't thought of it, because I'm guilty of saying, well, if that were me, I'd pack up, you know. But that's key. Why does he do that?
So it was interesting. I was teaching something the other day, and I was talking about headlines in the media. And let's say the first day the newspaper said, John beat Mary because dinner was late.
Mm-hmm.
The next day it says Mary was beaten because dinner was late. The third day it says Mary was beaten, and the fourth day it said Mary is a battered woman. She is now identified by something that happened to her.
Wow.
And where's John? Why are we not saying John's a beater? John's a loser. John needs to be fired. John needs to be kicked out of that faith community. We cannot hold the victims responsible. We can't hold the police or the service providers responsible. We as community have to stand up and say, I don't do a business deal with you. I don't laugh at your jokes. You are not welcome in my home because of the way you treat your wife.
Now, let me ask you this. And I've also heard that in some instances, women have called police, but yet the woman ends up being arrested. What about that?
Right, right. So, again, it has to do with the individual situation. So it may be that, you know, he comes at her, and she's doing this and puts a scratch on him. Well, when the police get out there, they say, look, she scratched me and I didn't lay a hand on her.
I got you.
There shall be an arrest if there is probable cause.
Okay.
She also, again, may not advocate for herself and say, yeah, I did hit him too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then the police are going to take her in too.
Right.
But instead of saying, I was trying to save my babies, I wish we as women knew how to advocate for ourselves. I was trying to save my baby. This was not my fault. It happened so many times. You know, so I remember a case. This was up in up in North Texas.
Yeah.
And a baby was killed. A baby died. They took her into the hospital, said she had jumped off the diving board at the apartment and did a belly flop and, you know, had internal injuries. Turned out that the hospital said, well, that's not what's causing that. We think something else did it. And the mom confessed to punching that baby in the stomach and killing her.
Yeah.
Now, everybody looked at that mom, except this wonderful district attorney up there, looked at that mom and said, you killed your child. What kind of monster are you? But let me ask you this. Why would a woman confess to killing her own child? Because he said, I'll kill your other two babies if you don't take the rap for this.
Oh, my.
Why are they arrested? Because maybe that's safer. Maybe that is just safer. But there are a million reasons that we at Genesis want women to know those are not your only alternatives. There is help and there is hope.
Let me remind everybody. Let's take a little quick reminder here. You are watching the Blog Talk Show. I was just thinking, and our guest today is Jan Langvine. I hope I'm okay. And she is the chief executive officer of Genesis Women's Shelter and Support Organization. And they are opening a new facility in the Oak Cliff area, and it will be at Lancaster Road and Ledbetter Drive, like Ledbetter and Lancaster. And it's a non-residential facility for Genesis. And by the way, y'all, Genesis Women's Shelter has been around for well over 30 years in different areas. And they're going to have all kind of services for women who have suffered domestic abuse. And there's going to be a thrift store right next to it, and it'll serve the women, plus the community can get involved. So Jan Langbein is telling us all about this. Now, let me go back to you talking about women doing things like this for the children. I mean, they're thinking about the children. What kind of impact does all of this have on children? What are they experiencing?
Norma, it's the saddest excuse of all of it. Of all excuses, I hear women say, I'm staying because of my kiddos.
Yeah.
Kids who are raised in a violent home are receiving on-the-job training to be tomorrow's victims and to be tomorrow's abusers.
Oh, my.
Little girls are learning how to get what they want through their fists. Mm-hmm. Little girls who attend to hide under the bed and in the closet when the fighting starts, or as it sounds, we'll go find a guy like dear old dad. You know, we just tend to do that. It's
yeah.
what we know. It's the language we speak.
Yeah.
You know, if you think of a child living in a violent home, let's say, you know, how old were you growing up before you knew there was French and German and Russian out there? How old do you bet you were?
Oh, gosh. High school.
When you had to take a language, right? Yeah, but so many of us, those kiddos who are raised where violence is the language, doesn't know that some houses don't have violence.
Yeah.
They don't know that there are kind parents out there and gentle men out there. Oh, I want to tell you about this too. Genesis has an organization called HEROES, and it stands for He Respects Others. And it is men from throughout this community, young, old, rich, poor, black, white, Hispanic, from all over this community who say, I have zero tolerance. I won't do it in my house, and I won't tolerate you doing it in your house. They come down, Norma, and they barbecue once a week at the shelter. They
Get
serve animals who have never been served by a man. They literally shoot baskets on our sport court with our kiddos who have never seen a gentleman. They mentor one-on-one with these little guys. Do I have time to tell you a special story?
Go ahead. Go for it.
Okay. I know I'm going to run out of time and keep saying, no, we have more to talk about. But we have this hero. His name is Randy Golden, and he's probably...
Women. Randy what?
Golden.
Okay.
And he's probably my age, 05 guy, right? And his mentee, his little boy, was... This isn't his real name because we don't get this out, but La Chantel, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It was a little African-American boy, probably 6 years old. And what they liked to do together was Legos. And Randy would come down once a week, and they'd do the Legos, right?
Okay.
He was living in our transitional housing. So one week, he comes down, La Chantel saying, hey, Randy, are you here? Are you here? And he comes around the corner, and the little boy looks up at his mom with tears in his eyes and basically says, I told you he wouldn't forget me. I told you he promised he'd be here. So Randy looks down at the guy, and he had just had a haircut, right? And kind of a buzz haircut. And he says, so, buddy, I see you got a haircut. Is that like a back-to-school haircut? And he said, no, I told the barber I wanted a haircut so I could look just like you.
Oh, wow.
That didn't mean I want to look like an old white guy.
Right, right.
It means I want to be gentle, and I want to be kind.
I want to be a hero. Yeah.
I want to be a hero.
Yeah.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. So that's what we do at Genesis. We take these children whose hearts look like Swiss cheese, and we put them back together. And through their art and their play and just being free, they get to tell. And they get to tell, and they begin to begin to heal.
Mm.
We have school on site. We have child care on site. We have a preschool on site where children can't be snatched out by an abusive parent or can't be told they're worth nothing. We tell them they are special and they're precious.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the Dallas Morning News, and it may have been, when did you leave there, Norma? How long have you been gone?
Oh, gosh, you were 2002, I think it was. 2002, oh. However long ago that was. But I still do, you know, the once a month column.
Good. Well, there was an article in the Dallas Morning News. It's been a couple of years ago. I can't think of the Reddit. But it was about a young man named Arturo Torres.
Okay.
Arturo grew up in Oak Cliff. He is now an artist and an illustrator, and he's just finished, I think, his third New York Times best-selling book with the writer, and he does all the art in it.
Okay.
And he'd been in New York, but he came back to live in Oak Cliff, and the whole article is about how he wanted to be a role model for kids in his neighborhood. But at the very end of this article, it's the interviewer said, so how is it you got interested in art? And he said, when I was 8 years old, my mom, who was beaten by my dad, my mom and I went to a place called Genesis Women's Shelter.
Get out!
And he said, and on Friday, Toy Day, they gave me an art kit. We gave him an art kit. Now, I don't know why we had it, number one, but somebody donated it. I don't know why we gave it to him and not the little girl next to him and gave him a truck. It's the hand of God, but I'm telling you, I see it again and again and again, that he got this art kit. And after I read that article, I was like, I don't remember him. I wish I knew him. I tracked him down and finally called him and said, you may not want to do this, but I would love to meet you. He came into my office and sat on that green couch back there.
Right.
And he cried. And he just said, he gave me, he's a big, large man, bear hugged me up and said, I've been practicing this because I want to say this to you. You helped an 8-year-old boy, and he turned into a good man.
Oh, man.
That's what we do here, Norma.
Let me just absorb that whole sharing, you sharing that with me. That really speaks to me about, and let me just kind of summarize it. Men who are, who know how to live properly and how to treat others with respect come to Genesis, and they work with families, and they, they're not setting out to be role models, I guess. They're just really being who they are. But them reaching out and interacting with these young people and these families, the children, like you said, maybe for the first time in their life, get to see a male who knows how to treat people and respect people and can set an example for the young person. And this example that you just talked about, you spoke to that young man. Help to give him that speaks to me.
And we have tons of stories like that. So Arturo, the artist, actually came down and we passed out our kits to all the kids in school, and he drew them and played with them for about 3 hours one afternoon, and so he paid it forward, basically. Our kids, we have an opportunity. People say, well, children are so resilient. They don't know what's going on. Mm-hmm. They were asleep. They absolutely know what's going on, and they stuff it until they get an automatic weapon and go shoot kids in school. So if we want to stop human trafficking, if we want to stop drugs and alcohol and teen babies, teen mamas, and we want to stop gun violence in this country, we need to stop domestic violence.
Now, I want to hear a little bit more about, you know, the beginning of Genesis. Now, and tell us, there are other locations. This current new location is being added on to other locations. Is Genesis in other states? Tell me a little bit more about Genesis.
Right. We're our own standalone nonprofit organization here in Dallas, and we do have a shelter, but then we added transitional housing on our safe campus, and then we have leasehold space over on Lemon Avenue for our non-residential. But this is another great project. We actually have bought a piece of land near Parkland Hospital, and we are building a building that will be 3-story. We can double our capacity. We always have a waiting list here. I'm so excited. We'll increase our legal clinics, because that's a tremendous need. Norma, when he can no longer hit her or hurt her, he puts on a suit and a tie and walks into court, and he says she's a drunk and a bad mother, and she loses her children, not to a man who wants them, but to a man who wants to win and hurt her in the way that would hurt her the most. So our legal clinic will double, our whole second floor floor will be Women and Children's Trauma Center.
Yeah.
And our third floor will be all the things that make that happen. So we're very excited about our new building. We're waiting to hear on some permits, which seem to be the problem of the day in Dallas, Texas, but we'll be going vertically soon.
I have to ask you, COVID, has it had much of a negative impact on your operation? How have y'all dealt with the whole COVID situation?
Oh, I tell you. Well, it's been hard on everybody. Let's just go ahead and say that.
Yeah.
My computer's even tired of Zoom calls. You know, it's a Zoom call. But when we first heard the word COVID, you know, there was no national leadership. We didn't know what it was. We didn't know what we were going to do about it. We had no face masks or hand sanitizer. We couldn't get it. We had to close the state, we had mandated stay home. We closed our shelter, closed our thrift store and our non-residential offices.
Okay.
But no one was to let the shelter close. There's just too many people who needed the help. What we also realized, even though we were at that time, our hotline numbers started to drop. You're quarantined in your home, the abuse in the next room, you can't call out. You cannot ask for help. And the fear of coming to a place where you might be exposed to COVID, your children might be exposed to COVID. So right at the first several months, we literally saw a decline, even though police calls were up and murders of women across the country were up, domestic homicides. Anyway, as it began to lift, then our phone was just flooded. Mm-hmm. And speaking of flooded, in the middle of COVID, just as we're seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, the storm came through Dallas and we lost electricity, which means we lost the lock on the front door and the pipes burst. And
oh, man.
Anyway, one of the things was our phone went out and so our hotline went down.
Oh, my.
I know it, right? Yeah. As a result of that, however, we now have text capabilities, which is just exploding. So our number, which is 214-946-HELP, 214-946-HELP, which is answered 24 hours a day. You can call that or you can text. And we've had women who text and say, he's asleep and I'm pretending that I'm in the shower.
Yeah.
And literally, can safety plans text? We had clients come in the next day, because she reached out by text and could. Mm-hmm. So we're excited about, we take one step backwards and two forwards.
Yeah, and I'm glad because I wanted to ask you about, and we still have some other things to talk about, but since we're at that point, now I heard you say that anyone in the general population, you have a hotline. You have a hotline, and a woman can figure out a way to get to a phone and dial 214, and I think it's going to be put in our chat. 214-946 help, H-E-L-P, and that is 4357. Okay, I'll say it again, 214-946-4357, which are the numbers corresponding to help. So 214-946-HELP, H-E-L-P. And you also have a website. Is that www.genesisshelter.org?
Yes, ma'am. And so the two words, Genesis, like the book in the Bible, and shelter run together. So two S's there in the middle.
Okay.
But doing that, great information regarding how to help a friend. What if it's your sister or your next door neighbor?
Okay. Okay.
What do you say?
Yeah.
How do you safety plan if it is you? What our services are, how you can help, how you can volunteer.
Okay. And now I want to ask, let me just remind the audience that you're watching, I Was Just Thinking, I'm your host, Norma Adams-Wade, and our guest today is Jan Langbein, and she is the CEO of Genesis Women's Shelter and Support, and they have a new facility going up in the Oak Cliff area, and it's really going to be a big help to African-American women. It's not exclusively for African-Americans, but it will really help the particular population in that area. And it's going to be located right at the intersection of Lancaster and Ledbetter in Oak Cliff. And there will be a thrift store that will sit right next to it. that will serve women and children and the community. It will be for the clientele, but the community can also have access. And I'm assuming make donations to it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, can you can make donations. Okay. And speaking of...
After we open.
Okay. Right.
But begin now and, you know, do a drive in your school or your faith community or whatever and start storing up things that you know you could pass on and share. It's being a part of the solution, Norma. A lot of people cannot pull out their credit card. I hope a lot of people can. But a lot of people who cannot, still, you've got an outfit that you haven't worn. I've got outfits I can't fit in anymore.
Right.
Those need to go down to that benefit. They're sort of still in good shape, and somebody can go get a job with that. Somebody can go, you know, back to church with that because he burned her clothes that she wore to church. You know, it just never ends. But we're blessed, and I think this agency is blessed because we're doing what we are supposed to be doing.
Right. I need to ask you, give us an idea of about how many families you've reached out to or that you've helped. How can we measure, you know, what you've done in terms of helping the number of clients or whatever?
Yeah, thousands. So our shelter remains full most all the time, and we can house 40 people, like about 15 moms and 25 kids. Yeah.
Okay.
15 moms, I'm sorry, and 25 kids.
Okay.
And transitional housing, we can have up to about 75 people in there in apartments.
Okay.
So shelter, it's a bedroom by yourself.
Okay.
And transitional housing, it's an apartment. But our biggest footprint is non-residential. We probably do 18,000 counseling hours a year over here at our non-residential component. It is, again, for people who have left or have not left. We make no judgment. We walk beside somebody and with an understanding of the trauma that surrounds the abuse, the trauma of not being believed, the trauma that, you know, a sexual assault can last 15 minutes, but the next 15 years you can't sleep and you can't eat and you cry and, you know, the police didn't believe you and your pastor said go home and pray about it and all the trauma that surrounds it. That's what we can help with. One of the leaders in the trauma response in Dallas.
Okay, now let's talk money. How do y'all stay functioning?
You see this white hair? I worry about money all the time. So we are privately funded, and I don't mean I have a sugar daddy. It means I have a team who is asking corporations and foundations and faith communities and individuals to make a donation. That is a tax-deductible donation. Our budget is $8 million a year, and that is a lot of money, but it's 8 million promises that we make to this community that we're going to be here when you need help.
Okay.
We're going to be here when your coworker or your sister needs help.
Mm.
And so we are constantly having special events. Oh, my gosh, we're having one talking about that area. We have had for the last maybe 5 years an opportunity to recognize the first ladies of the faith communities of Southern Dallas and in their domestic violence ministries and people who have been doing the work and so on and so forth. And that event, the proceeds from that event actually will help fund that Southern Dallas effort in that community.
Okay.
There are about 250,000 people who worship every Sunday in about a 5-mile radius, some of the mega churches and then some of the smaller churches that we are friends with, but there seems to have been a disconnect after we take off our hats and we lay down our praise, and now what? Well, you're North Dallas, and we want to break that, and we do that through this First Ladies Bruncheon. However, it was scheduled for September. It has now we've had to push it back because of the COVID restrictions from the county. So it looks like it'll be in October, and I'd love for you to get that information.
Okay.
And
now in our chat, our publisher, Cheryl Smith, she says, Ms. Langbein, thanks so much for the work you do. Sadly, the domestic violence cases are involving younger and younger perpetrators. What about that? Younger perpetrators.
Yes, ma'am. National statistics are going to say that one out of every four adult women will know domestic violence. So think about where you live and think about two people on that side of you and one person on that side of you. Somebody there is knowing domestic violence. However, the studies also say that between the ages of 12 and 20, it's one out of every three. Teen dating violence, my children and my granddaughters are at higher risk than I am of being in a violent relationship. Mm-hmm. Our young people watch these horrible things on TV.
Yeah.
They watch these horrible music videos that are misogynistic and objectify women, and they think that's the way women should look or behave. They think that's the way women should be treated. Or, and so younger and younger, we're seeing fewer efforts to talk about healthy relationships. So she's right. She's right. We are seeing younger and younger perpetrators. But again, we have another organization called STAR, Students Tackle Abusive Relationships.
Okay.
And so we have representatives from different schools. I think we may have 20 schools across Dallas who will do efforts. They'll put it in the school paper. They'll do something on football night saying, I signed this oath never to hit my girlfriend. But again, it can't be break up with him if he's mean to you. It's got to be John hit Mary because then it was like, we got to hold John accountable.
Yeah.
We have to hold these boys accountable.
Right.
If you look at the mass shootings that have happened, and it made me think of that Parkland high school, Parkland.
No, I'm with you. But
yeah, the high school.
Right.
That boy went in there because a girl didn't want to date him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you look at Sutherland Springs, the shooting at the First Baptist Church down there a couple of years ago, they did mass murder in Texas, and he went there to kill his ex-wife and his mother-in-law, and they just didn't happen to be in church on that Sunday morning, and he killed, I don't know, 29 people from babies to seniors. If we want to stop, again, if we want our streets and our churches and our schools to be safe, we have to make our homes safe.
Yeah. Now, I want to get back to churches, but let me comment. Here's another comment in the chat, and it says, now you gave the phone number, but talk about this a little bit more. It says, how can people get involved? What else can we say?
I love that question. Okay. You know, again, you can get involved by helping support us. If you work all the time and you don't have time to volunteer, we've held off on our volunteers recently because of COVID.
Yeah, yeah.
You and your best friends could get together and cook a meal and deliver it down to the shelter.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's...
But you, and now that gives me a thought, because I know that, well, not just Dallas, but in most cities, we've got organizations like sororities and fraternities,
yes,
who are constantly looking for public service to come do.
To us. Yes. The Dallasans are really great with us. We have a couple of sororities that are already working with us, but there's so many chapters of that.
Right,
you know,
right.
So we would love to have the help. And again, we would love to have the men. Now, we don't just take any man because we have to be sure he's not an abuser trying to look good in court.
Right.
But, so we do background checks and we try to have somebody recommend them or something like that. But we would love to have more men who can relate to our children who are going to be getting services down at Lancaster and Ledbetter.
Okay, now we've got about what? I think we've got about maybe five minutes
no,
left.
No, I'm having so much fun.
But during this last 5 minutes, I want to get back, and you may have to come back.
I hope so. If you let me come back, I'd love to.
But anyway, you said something early on in the conversation. Here's a woman, she may go to her minister and it revealed to him what's going on. And I can hear it in my ear. He'll say, well, go home and pray about it. So, I mean, how can we deal with that? Do our churches and our ministers need to, I don't know, turn over a new leaf? What can we do about that?
Yes, ma'am, they do. Now, we have some. Bishop Jakes is wonderful. Pastor Carter is wonderful about his stand against domestic violence. But I hear every day, a woman said, I was battered for 15 years, and when I got divorced, I was no longer welcome at my communion table. And when I was no longer welcome at my communion table, I was no longer welcome at my mama's dinner table. We have to look not just at the pastor, but the faith community as a whole. I hear things like, if you tell or if you leave, you are not a Proverbs 31 wife.
Yeah. don't go there.
Yes, I am. I'm going right there. Because if you read Proverbs 31, the first few chapters, the first few verses are talking about this queen who's given the kingdom to
She's doing all this work and nobody else in the house is doing it. She's washing, she's cooking,
yes.
She's cleaning, and everybody else is just leisurely.
And Mama said, quit your drinking and quit your messing around and go find you a wife who can make you proud in this community. But unfortunately, it's now just put on the wife. Same thing with wives submit to your husbands. You don't read on down where husbands love your wives like Christ did the church.
Oh, my God.
Many times, even in Judaism, Norma, there's a phrase called shalom bayit, which means peace in the home. And I've heard Jewish women say, if I leave or I tell, I've broken shalom bayit, instead of he's broken peace in the home. We actually have a lecture series coming up. Another way people can help on our website. I know I'm talking faster now that I know I can. But on our website, it says events that we're going to have. And there is a free event coming up called our lecture series. And there's going to be a panel of faith leaders from an imam to a pastor to a bishop to whatever, talking about how you can end domestic violence in your faith community. But it cannot just be a brochure, why don't you get out? You have to be able to hear her and hold him accountable.
Okay.
The Bible says, I can't remember how it said, but he talks about, forgive and forget. Forgive and forget is Shakespeare. Forgive and hold accountable is the Bible. And our faith communities must hold accountable. You can't be on the board of whatever if you abuse your family.
And that's a whole nother discussion about.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
Just go to that free event, lecture series. It's in September. And listen to the different faith leaders. And let's have another conversation.
Do you know where it will be? I mean, has the location been selected?
It's virtual.
Okay. Now, during our wrap-up, what areas have we not touched on? What points do you want to make that we didn't get to? When do you think the facility may open?
Okay. Points we haven't touched on, or maybe we have. I just want everybody to know if you or someone you know needs help, there is help and hope, and it's a phone call away. I want people to know that I want them to go to our website and learn how to help a friend. It may not be today. It may be a month from now that you come across somebody who needs to know 946 help, and you can do that. And, you know, believe her if your next-door neighbor comes over. Believe her. Tell her there's help and hope. Help her safety plan. And it can be as simple as, if I turn on my porch light on my back door after 10 o'clock, please dial 911. Have a safety plan. Don't come over. But we can help with that. And then, of course, I'm sorry, what was the other question?
Well, when do you
when
think?
Touched on,
when do you think it might open?
That was it. When is it? I'm hoping end of November, by Thanksgiving. We'll all have something to be thankful
for. Is there
about.
Like a, what do you call it, grand opening, a ribbon cutting?
Yes, we will. Casey Thomas, council member Casey Thomas.
Okay.
Is our councilman. He'll be there. Miss Black Texas is... this is her platform. She's already promised to be there. The mayor will be there. Dr. Cynthia Mickens-Ross is a new board member of mine, and she's at Methodist Charlton. We want the hospitals. Veterans Hospital is right there. So we will, and so we would love to have you there as well.
I'm asking everybody to join me in thanking you for coming on and telling us about this vital service, and we want to get involved as much as we can. And each person, as you say, think of a way that we can contribute to this worthwhile cause. And we wish you all the success. And thank you for everything that you've already done. We very much appreciate you. So this has been Jan Langbein.
Right.
And she is the Chief Executive Officer for Genesis Women's Shelter. And it will open sometime in November, probably, at Lancaster and Ledbetter, right at the intersection of Lancaster and Ledbetter. Thank you. Go forward and thank you. And go forward and conquer.
Yeah, I think we have a lot to just be thinking about now.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you, Norma.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, everybody. Well, there's a lot that needs to be done. There's a lot of ground that needs to be covered. And our publisher, Cheryl Smith, says that Texas Metro News will be at that opening whenever it is. And Dan named all of the leaders, Casey Thomas and Cynthia Meekins-Ross and Miss Black Texas and the mayor and folk of that ilk will be at that opening. What a worthwhile cause. And what domestic violence. And as publisher Cheryl Smith pointed out, perpetrators are getting younger and younger because this is what they're seeing. And children do what they see. And I was so encouraged when the CEO mentioned that this male, positive male role models in the group called Heroes, that's an offshoot of service for Genesis Women's Shelter, males who are living the right way living as positive examples are coming forward and interacting with the young people who are in the shelter and the families and showing them that just because you've seen violence all your life, this is not the way it is. Let me show you how a real man should treat his wife or his girlfriend and his children. Let me show you the right way that it's done. And so the group is called Heroes, that also works with Genesis Women's Shelter. And then there's a group called STARS, that's students that are also learning early the right way to have a non-violent relationship. And so we are so grateful for that. It's about time for us to wrap up. And, you know, we always rely on Teddy Pendergrass, Harold Melvin, and the Blue Notes. And they tell us to wake up, everybody. And today is certainly time for everyone to wake up. He says, no more sleeping in bed. No more backwards thinking. And the example of the woman who goes to her minister and says, my husband is beating me. And the minister says, go home and pray about it. And, well, no, we got to do more than that. And the ministers and the faith groups have got to do more than that. Got to serve these women who are being beaten and abused, and the children are having to watch it. And often the children are flung across the room and flung up against the wall. Now, we can pray. Yeah, we can pray, but we got to put feet to our prayers. We got to put feet to our prayers and take action. And so you got the hotline number if you want to do some kind of service, and it is 214-946-HELP, H-E-L-P, and that's 4357. Those are the numbers parallel to HELP. So the hotline number, if you know somebody, your neighbor, your sister, your cousin, yourself, who's being impacted by domestic violence, pick up that phone and dial that hotline, 214-946-HELP. H-E-L-P, and that's 4357. So Teddy Pendergrass says, maybe you can hear the music. I can't, but he says, wake up, everybody. No more sleeping in bed. No more backwards thinking. Time to think ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred. There's war, there's poverty, and then he addresses the teachers. He says, wake up all the teachers. He says, wake up all the teachers. Time to teach a new way. maybe then the students will listen to what you have to say. Teach a new way. Maybe then the students will listen to what you have to say. If you're tuning up, Teddy, you're going to listen to him bring those words, to bring those words to life. Let's take a listen.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back to thinking, time to thinking ahead.
The
world's changed so very much. What it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Wake up all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. World won't get no better if we just let it be. Na, 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 na. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it, just you and me. Wake up all the doctors, make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and who catch all the air. They don't have so very long before their judgment day. So won't you make them happy before they pass away? Wake up all the builders, time to build a new man. I know we could do it if we all lend a hand. Only thing we have to do is put it in our mind. Surely things will work out. They do it every time. The world won't get no better if we just let it be.
No.
The world won't get no better. We gotta change it. Just you and me.
Wake up, everybody.